The Guardian.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm here, for those of you who are later listening on the podcast, my introduction has been disrupted already by the appearance from out of Russell Hoban's bag of one of the key characters in his novel Ridley Walker, which is indeed the topic of this evening's discussion. Because we're here to talk to Russell about Ridley Walker, which was first published in 1980 and which features, as I'm sure all the aficionados in this room know, a character I believe first mentioned in English in Pepys's diary in 1662.
Probably was.
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Punch.
Putra.
At least three of the really quite famous novelists who've done performances before at the Guardian Book Club have separately named this book during the course of our discussions as one of their big influences. In fact, not one of their big influences. In the case of a couple, David Mitchell and Will Self, they simply said, yeah, Ridley Walker, that's where I got it. Yeah, I got it from Ridley Walker. And Margaret Atwood also talked about, you know, how she'd sort of been influenced or inspired by reading this. So I thought it's about time we got the thing itself, the book itself, instead of listening to these second order people, that we got the true origins of it. And what do you think, having written one of the most famous ones that's ever been written, what's the appeal of that particular sort of nightmarish scenario, for not just for a novelist, but perhaps for readers as well?
It's perhaps analogous to the appeal of horror stories and ghost stories in a separate category, of course. People like to read about people in the last extremity of nothing left. I believe that famous novelist Cormac McCarthy has written a novel called The Road, which is something like that.
Yes. And why do you think people like to read?
The same as they like to read about castaways. They like to read about people in extremity.
It's stripping people down to to being bare-forked animals sort of thing, is it?
Absolutely.
And what was that, the appeal of for you in writing it?
What happened with me, when I first visited Canterbury Cathedral, the occasion was because the night before, I'd been invited to talk at the St. Augustine Teacher Center. There were about three people there in attendance, the man who had brought me, myself, and some other luckless character. And it was explained to me that it was a bad time, and there was a plague, the wells had been poisoned, I don't know what. But the next day, to make up for it, he took me to Canterbury Cathedral. And people ask me how I get my ideas. And my answer is they come to me out of the air, because the air in different places is different. And the air is the atmosphere. The atmosphere is the medium through which the history of a place and its essence come to me. And in Canterbury Cathedral, I remember looking up at that numinous fan vaulting, and I could feel this uprush of yearning and prayer and hope and fear. It filled me, that's all I can say. And I saw on the north wall the faded remnants of this 15th century wall painting, The Legend of St. Eustace, and opposite it, Professor Tristram's reconstruction. If you Google for St. Eustace, you'll find that he has no official standing amongst the beatified. He's completely a work of fiction. Who knows where he comes from? Maybe he turned up on some Middle Ages cornflakes box. It's a bad trip. He's out hunting, and he sees a stag, between the antlers of which is a little figure of crucified Christ. And he falls on his knees and is instantly converted, and makes a vow and sells all his possessions. and sets off on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem with his wife and two children. And immediately his wife is taken off by pirates. He carries on with the two kids. He comes to a river. He takes one boy across and leads him and comes back for the other. And while he's in the middle of the river, a wolf carries off one and a lion the other. There he is in the middle of the river. He's treading water and hoping for the best. And because of my life at that particular time, I had a strong fellow feeling for Yusuf. I was in the middle of a kind of river of my own. I identified with him. Oh, as the story continues in this painting, which reads from the bottom to the top, in time he is reunited with his wife and sons, and he becomes a general in the Roman army. And on the occasion of being asked to sacrifice to the Roman gods, he refuses. And so he and his wife and two kids are roasted alive in a brazen bull, and their souls are gathered up in a big handkerchief in heaven. How did I get from the Eustace story to Ridley Walker? Well, whatever I've been able to do with writing arises from being friends with my head. I'm used to my head. I know its twists and its turns and its vagaries, and I know its hobo journeys to unknown destinations, riding the blinds on fast freights. I go along on those hobo trips, and sometimes I get thrown out of the train in the middle of nowhere, and sometimes I get to the Big Rock Candy Mountain. And that's what happened this time. My mind fished up a couple of articles by Edmund Wilson in the New Yorker magazine, in which he wrote about Punch and Judy men, the men who make the puppets and those who perform with them. When I looked at the Eustace painting, zonk, Punch and Judy hooked up with the Eustace locomotive and off we went.
It's funny, the St. Eustace story, you tell it, but of course it appears in the novel itself, and it's the only bit of the novel written in sort of standard English.
Yes.
Abel Goodpart subjects the piece of recognisable English prose describing this legend and the depiction of this legend to kind of his own analysis of
yes.
what it means. And it's bizarrely sort of wrong. He says, some parts is easier work it out nor others. There's bits of it we'll never know for certain what they mean. I don't know, this is me reading it, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It says, a legend, that's a picture, what's depicted, which is to say pictured on a wall. It's done with some kind of paint, call it fidelity. Saint, S-T, which appears, of course, in the script, is short for sent, meaning this bloke Eustace, he didn't just turn up, he was sent. A.D. 120, that's the year count they used to have it, gone from year one right the way to bad time. A.D. 120, A.D. means all done. 120 years all done, they're saying. That's when they begun this picture in 120, nor they never got it finished till 1480, is what it says here. Well, you know, there ain't no picture could take 1,360 years to do. These here year numbers is about something else. Maybe we'll never know that. I mean, there's quite a lot of legends and stories these people tell themselves. I mean, that seems quite an important part of the book, how these characters, after some unimaginable catastrophe, sort of reinterpret, often in these mistaken ways, the sort of fragments they find lying around them.
One of the bits that I'm most pleased with is when they cremate Bruder Walker, Ridley's father, and they do it on the bye-bye hump.
Yes.
Which is kind of a childish way of describing a tumulus or yeah. a burial mound. And there's no knowing who's buried in the burial mound. They don't know. But they know it's the bye-bye hump. It's where they say goodbye to somebody. And they sing this space-age hymn.
Yes.
Past the sovereign galaxies and flaming nebulae, power us beyond the farthest reaches of the sky. Thine the hand which shapeth the black, guide us there and guide us back. And they think that thine is a verb. They all thine hands when they say goodbye to Bruder Walker.
Quite a lot of their sort of funny reconstructions of things have a childish aspect to them, actually.
Yes, they
quite,
do.
Quite so Dover is Do It Over, and Sandwich is Sam's Itch, and what's Bollockstones? Where's that?
The names have all been degraded.
Yes.
As a revulsion against the cleverness of the time that brought them to where they are. These are the shit places from bad time, you know, and they're part of Full Circle Nine-wise.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when I read it, I didn't know in advance that the language was going to be any different from the language I was used to reading when I opened novels. There are grave academic analyses of the actual systematic phonetic patterns of the language you've invented here, and debates amongst linguists about how systematic they are. Did you know?
Well,
that?
What happened was that when I first began to write it, I started to write it in straight English. And then it just left straight English behind and got into this sort of language. And technically, the language has the function of slowing the reader down to Ridley's speed of perception. But other than that, the language is an active character in the story, and the language really works. Things came to me that that I didn't know were available. As I was saying to Alan, the competition winner, just before this, when you get into a certain channel of thought, things feed into it that you wouldn't have thought of. Like a listener describing the things that he listened in the story, The Other Voice, Owl of the World. He listened to the footsteps of the moth and the ants crying in their holes. Where did I get that, the ants crying in their holes? I got it because the listener thought of it. It isn't just the language, but what makes the book solid is the whole culture. Their songs, their stories, their rhymes. It's a solid three-dimensional book of a kind of life in a particular time.
But because it's a first-person narrative, and because Ridley knows no world apart from his own, I mean, you have been very careful not to have him, as it were, tell us things. So we have to find out things, don't we? He writes a lot about things he doesn't understand.
Yes.
But doesn't bother to tell you about the things he does understand. Of course, the things that he does understand, you want to know about. You want to know what their beliefs are, and, you know, what is a connection man and what's he supposed to do. Did you have to sort of cut stuff out of it to get it down to that?
Oh, yes. The first 2 years I wrote 500 pages that weren't it. So I went back to page one and started again and compressed it, concentrated it. It was interesting to me that Ridley revealed himself to me as I wrote. I never have a plan or an outline, and I didn't know who Ridley would be, but I found I liked him. He was kind of like Huck Finn, a sort of ingenuousness and at the same time an ingenuity and a dead-level way of looking at things and recognizing what was what was true and what was false. And a great deal of the book is an ongoing religious experience where he is trying to find his place in the cosmos, and he ends up saying, Spirit of God, without knowing anything about God. And when he first kills the boar on his naming day, they all yell, Offered. And at that time, they were offering to her what has her womb in Cambry.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a confusion of religion in there. And in the chapter where he is actually in Cambry, and he goes through ever so many changes, it's kaleidoscopic. He is sodomized by the father, and he can't get it up for her what has her womb in Cambry, and he's going all different kinds of ways in a confusion of religious experience.
When he says Spirit of God, and when he shouts that out, it's the power ring that does it. So round Cambry, there was once. You make it sound like a sort of particle accelerator.
That's what I had in mind.
Oh, right, okay. It's that sort of electrical, technological force that he associates with religious experience, isn't it?
When he stands in the ring ditch and he feels this power circling over him.
Yeah, and the dogs cower, don't they? The dogs are really important, I mean, they...
The dogs are, and I've been asking myself, what is it with the dogs? Well, first of all, it's the blackness of them. I'm a Schwarzophile, a Dunkelphile. And I didn't want them to be like ordinary dogs, shaggy guys that wag their tails and have floppy ears. I based them on the physiognomy of the hyena, which has a bum lower than its shoulders and a small head and long front legs. And they're metaphysical dogs. They're not just straight Fidos. They're in touch with the first knowing. And through them, Ridley gets it from them. So that he is tuned into that first knowing, even when he's not aware of it. Mm. And a page in the book that made me cry when I read it this time, I think it was after Good Parley and Granser got their heads blown off, and Ridley and the dogs are roading, the black leader shoves his nose under Ridley's hand, and he said, that dog, just like him with his yellow eyes and like death on four legs, he wanted to be petted. That's when I cried for the dead, he says. That's when I cried. It really got to me.
I also found myself presuming, maybe, because it all takes place within 10 or 12 days, I can't remember quite, at a certain time of year, but it has the effect of making you think that there's a kind of post-apocalypse weather as well.
It's always raining.
It's always raining, yeah, or grey, or he's got a word, hasn't he? What's it called? Gerzel.
Gerzel.
Yeah, we've got some proper readers in the audience.
And at one point he says, put me on a muddy road in a black night in the rain and I'm home.
And the territory, which I fear when I first read it, I looked at the map and I didn't immediately recognise East Kent, which is what it is in origins. I mean, that's quite an important part of it, that somehow the sort of geographical limitation.
It's very concentrated, and that was a conscious artistic decision, because the first 500 pages that weren't it, everything was scattered over too much geography, and the long chapters. There was one long chapter about a paper mill where they made the Rizzlers and the writing paper.
Oh, really? Because people complained about the Rizzlers, you know.
Yeah.
Where do they come from? They've got Rizzlers. They haven't got horses, but they've got Rizzlers.
They got Rizzlers. Well, paper's an easy thing to make.
Yeah.
You make it out of vegetation, out of grass and so forth. And they were thinking of making a map, and then that seemed like a bad luck thing to do.
That geographical sense is very, very powerful to your sense of what it might be like to live this, for want of a better word, primitive life. That sort of limitation to the present and this small, small territory that Ridley's walking around. You know, he ends up discovering this this character, Punch.
In the digging at Widder's Stump.
In the digging. I mean, you've told us, you know, how you came upon Punch. But why is Punch matter in the novel?
As Good Parley says when he's doing a Punch show for Ridley, Punch is a law to himself. He's so old he can't die. I suppose he's the id, absolutely lawless force that wants what it wants immediately. Why will Punch always kill the baby? I don't know. It's on me to find out. So he is the spirit of rebellion that Ridley digs up in the digging at Widder's Dump, and it has a dead hand in it.
Mm.
When Belknap Fist, Nobel physicist, Belknap Fist, when he says, what's that you've got? Give it here. Ridley grabs his hand, flings him over his shoulder into the mud and over the fence and gone with the dogs who are waiting for him outside, because the dogs were prescient. They knew that they'd had an eye on him before. The dogs are Ridley's backup, his allies, his friends, to such an extent that when Durster Potter gave Ridley aggro, they killed him. They tore out his throat and his genitals and left him dying there.
So at the end, tell me, I'm opening it up in a second, but just briefly, the ending. At the end, Ridley and his new companion...
Ernie Orfing,
who's just been responsible for a terrible thing, as a blinding his former companion, they're off sort of doing the punch show around inland. That's going to be their mission.
They just say it's on them to do it. Orfing, who has not been an exemplary character heretofore, when Ridley says, maybe we best lie low till things settle down, Orfing says, no, let's start doing things and then things will settle down.
Perhaps the moment has come to ask the better readers in this room, who would like to ask Russell anything? We have a roving mic. I'm sorry about the roving mic, but it enables you to be eventually podcast to the waiting millions.
Hi, I'm just curious as to how long it took Russell altogether to write the novel. And also, was it difficult to sustain yourself financially if it was taking 4 or 5 years?
5.5 years.
Yeah, and how did you sustain yourself financially?
I sustained myself financially with my children's books. I have one commercial success, and that is a series of books, Bedtime for Frances, A Baby Sister for Frances.
I'd always lived in London. I moved out a few years ago to East Kent, and in my book club, we looked at Ridley Walker, which everyone knew because they'd been students and read it. As a Londoner, I knew your children's books, the Frances books, and it seemed to me that you must have been writing them at the same time, and I can't imagine how you reconciled writing the Frances books and writing Ridley Walker. Were you doing them at the same time? And if so, how did you manage it?
I think it's called talent.
I'm interested in this prescience thing. I've been haunted by it ever since I started reading your books, and probably like a lot of other people here, I get this weird feeling you've written it for me. Even tonight when I picked up the last ticket available just as I got online, what I'm interested in is it's in a lot of your books, a sort of prescience. It's like breathing in the air and there it is, a sort of synchronicity, things happening just how they're meant to happen, a sort of playing around with fate and free will and skating along between those things. Am I right in discerning this? And what's your general philosophy about the way that, I suppose, we act in this life? I was just listening to someone on the radio talking about the idea that sometimes people make decisions before they think about the decision that they're going to make, you know? The hand reaches out and then you do it.
All of my books are an exploration. And as I've said many times, I never have a plan. I never have an outline. I fly by the seat of my pants. The action comes out of the characters and the characters cause more action. So, as Lorna says, there's a thing in us that don't have no name. And I think there's a thing in me that makes me go on with that exploration.
Hi, Russ. It's Martin Eve here. I was just thinking, in Ridley Walker, there are very conflicting depictions of the malignant or benevolent influence of science. So the big cleverness is the cause of the catastrophe, but the power ring has a redemptive capacity to it and a spirituality that can be found therein. If we assume that we don't want mankind to descend to the world of Ridley Walker, what do we have to do to temper science and that cycle that dystopian fiction so often picks on?
Well, when Ridley sees these shining machines at Forkstone, he says, oh, what we've been, well, what we've been and what we've come to. And he realizes that there was a grandeur in that kind of achievement that he longs for. Looking at what happens at CERN in the big power ring there, and looking at what the Hubble telescope gives us, the space station, how we get closer and closer to the beginning of time. There's a hunger for answers, and it's connected, I think, with the mystery of consciousness. What a strange thing consciousness is, you know. What is this looking out through our eye holes? And this consciousness that inhabits us. I'm not even sure it is us. This consciousness that inhabits us wants to put things together, wants to organize the elements that come into it from the universe into some kind of recognizable shape.
I fear that Russell would go on. He'd go on and on. I've got to stop him. I'd just like to thank him so much for coming and talking about this book, which we've all wanted him to talk to us about for a long, long time. Thanks very much. Thanks very much.
Thank you for inviting me. And thank you for being...
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.